Ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
Ticklish business. I'm Kristen Lopez, and this week, with the end of the TCM Classic Film Festival, that means you get to listen to the festival that was with all of our TCM Film Festival audio. But before we get to that, we'd like to remind everyone that if you haven't checked out our Patreon at patreon.com/ticklishbiz, you should. We do additional bonus pods, including doubled features, looking at remakes, and based on a true podcast, looking at biopics and true crime, as well as our series, But Have You Read the Series? We also give out regular care packages and movies and gifts and let you guess on an episode. It's at patreon.com/ticklishbiz. And don't forget that Emily and I both have books out. We are also currently writing more books. You can order our books wherever you buy them. And our new Redbubble store has some fabulous art, all designed by Samantha Richardson and Terrence Hiltz. If you were at the festival, you might have gotten one of our many Makoko buttons. You can find out where to buy all of that at ticklishbiz.redbubble.com. So let's dive into our 2024 TCM Classic Film audio. You are going to be hearing the introductions to North by Northwest, Gidget, and Them. We have way more over on our Patreon for the purposes of this episode. We didn't want to make a 2.5 hour episode for everybody to listen to, so head over to Patreon after you listen to this so you can hear the rest. Enjoy!
It's complicated, the holiday, something so to give, the intern, so many brilliant films, and she's also an ardent Cary Grant admirer, as we all are. So please welcome Nancy Meyers. Thanks so much for coming, Nancy.
Oh my gosh, I can't see.
We were talking how brilliant this script is for North by Northwest, written by Ernest Lehman. And what's amazing to consider is that, you know, Ernest Lehman said he wanted to create the Hitchcock picture to end all Hitchcock pictures. And it does have a lot of the tropes that we love in Hitchcock films: wrong man on the run, Hitchcock blonde, you know, big action set piece. But it's a brilliantly written script. So can you tell us your thoughts on the script?
Sure. Well, I'm not sure when tropes became tropes, because I don't really know that, but I don't see it that way exactly, which I mentioned to you before. I think the script's fantastic because it is like The Wrong Man, and that he's the wrong man, but it's filled with humor, romance, espionage. I mean, it's more exciting. It's a much more exciting, adventurous, romantic. It could be a romantic comedy in a way. I mean, and there are moments, I know this isn't the script, supposedly, I don't know, but you know when, most of you have seen it, right? Has anybody not seen it? Because I don't want to ruin anything. Okay, don't listen. But you know, there's a scene where they fill him with booze, so they put him in a car. The idea is that he kills himself, and that's how they get rid of him. And he plays it like Chevy Chase. You know, it's pure, I don't know why I picked Chevy Chase, but it's pretty muddy and funny and comedic. And so I think there was a real nod towards comedy in the screenplay, and fantastic dialogue. Ernest Lehman's a great writer. He wrote Sound of Music, West Side Story, something to do with Sabrina. I don't know if that's before Billy Wilder, or Billy Wilder brought him in at some point, I'm not sure, but he's written great movies, and he writes really fabulous dialogue. And watching the movie 1,000,000 times, I have, I'm reminded how hard, as a writer, how hard it is to start a movie, to start writing. I wouldn't say the whole first act. Am I too loud?
No.
Just I wouldn't say the whole first act. Wait, there's an echo, though, right?
Yeah, there is.
Oh, okay. Thought this was the beginning of the end. But, you know, they have a lot to establish in a very short amount of time. He is basically kidnapped. I'm not going to throw anything because the first 5 minutes of the movie, it happens. So they have about 4 minutes to set up who this person is,
what his life is, how he operates, how, you know, and it's so beautifully done because I'm sure it was really hard to figure out what are we going to say in the first few minutes of this movie till we know who this guy is. Because he keeps saying, I'm not George Catlin, but the audience doesn't really know who Roger Thornhill is all that well, but you find out he's got a relationship with his mother, which is adorable. He's sweet with his secretary. Something Cary Grant, we'll never get to the second question, obviously. Something Cary Grant always did was he had just like this great camaraderie with the women on screen. I think it's one of the things that makes him one of maybe the great, in my mind, the greatest of all screen actors. Because you don't feel the acting ever with this guy. And even with the secretary in the first 2 minutes of the movie, he's cute with her, sweet with her. It's not a boss-secretary relationship. Anyway, they've got to establish a life. And just watch I know you'll get wrapped up in it, but just to see how well. And they even picked that he's in advertising, so he's clever. He's got to be clever through this whole movie to keep alive.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of my favorite pieces of dialogue or the scene that I love the most, which I think you do as well, is the train scene. So this is the first time we see Cary Grant with Eva Marie Saint playing Eve Pendle. And what I like about that scene, you know, and I'm not giving anything away, but just the way that I love when there's two characters who are not really saying what they mean. So it's so full of double meaning. They're concealing what their real purpose is. And it's also full of double entendre.
It's kind of like sexy. It's kind of like The Greatest Date. But my favorite line in the movie is actually not in that scene. I mean, I won't give this part away, but he discovers something about the Eva Marie Saint character, and he says to her, how does a girl like you get to be a girl like, how does a girl like you, does it get to be a girl like you or become a girl like you? I'd be so happy. I just stopped work for weeks if I wrote that.
And as you were saying about Cary Grant, you know, often he is not the one doing the pursuing of women. The women are pursuing him, which is certainly true of Eve Kendall, and she has another, you know, agenda behind that. And there's also a great moment in a hospital. I mean, I think with Cary Grant, you know, he really was in on the joke of Cary Grant.
Yes, completely. Yeah, he knew what he looked like, so he doesn't pretend he's anything else but this phenomenal-looking person who happens to be tall, wear a clothes grade, and always have a tan. And he has been quoted as this is most important acting technique is to have a tan. But wait, what were you saying? Oh, the girl. Oh, yeah. So it's not even just this movie, Alicia. I mean, both the Hepburn ladies chased him like crazy. Katharine Hepburn in Bringing Up Baby, Audrey in Charade. They chase him. Ingrid Bergman twice in two movies. Okay, you know, what's the great one Stanley Donen did? The other one. With Ingrid Bergman.
Notorious.
No, the other one, not Notorious. The other one. What is it? No.
Wayne Shadows.
No, that's Grace Kelly. Industry. Don't get old. This is what happens. He said, I'm sorry, I think you come up this, you know, I'll marry her. And she thinks for about 2 minutes and leaves. He leaves her apartment and then she calls down to the lobby and invites him to go to the ballet with her. Right. You know, the woman can't. I think it's somewhat accidental, but these women chase him through, and he has so much to play with that other actors never seem to pick up on.
And what do you think about the casting of Eva Marie Saint in this film? Because before this movie, she sort of played more of like the everyday girl, the girl next door, but here she is, the glamorous Hitchcock blonde.
Yeah, I loved her in the movie. I thought she was, I thought her acting was fantastic. I think she had a really hard part, and I thought she played it beautifully. I thought she was wonderful, and Hitchcock, I was listening to, God bless you, I was listening to this Truffaut interview with Hitchcock, you know, they did that book, but I think it was from these tapes that they did, where he interviewed him, and he really went off on a tangent about Eva Marie Saint.
Should I say this?
Yeah, well, he really groomed her to be that thing that he loved. You know, the girl in the suit with blonde hair and young and skinny and smart and hard to figure out. And he said she did it beautifully, but then she went off and made a movie after it, and he said she didn't maintain any of it. Like, it's funny that I would think he would think she would hold on to that for another part. But it seemed to really bother him in this interview.
Yeah, I don't know, because he was so particular about everything in his film, including the way the women looked, and he wanted that particular look for her. And she pulls it off so well, and she has great chemistry with Cary Grant. And to your point about comedy, I think one thing I love about Cary Grant is that he's so tall, he's so suave, he's so handsome and elegant, and he's also an acrobat. You know, so he can contort his body for physical comedy.
He does, because it's a very odd combo of being elegant and being able to do physical comedy. And the actors through the years that have been great at physical comedy, Steve Martin, by the way, can do that. But there aren't, it's not a type, that's not a thing most people can do. You can pull off both, yeah.
Yeah, and one thing that's amazing about this film, and you'll see it with the restoration, is the production design, especially the Mount Rushmore scenes. You know, they had to recreate Mount Rushmore inside a soundstage. So you actually got to work with the production designer, Robert Boyle?
Yes, yes. I worked with Bob Boyle on Private Benjamin, my first movie, but, you know, I was just a little different. Or I definitely didn't. He deserved it. But, you know, I was 29 and probably kind of dumb and didn't know this great artist who was working on the movie. I knew the sets he was building for us were fantastic. He built the inside of a French country house that was gorgeous on a soundstage. But it was kind of, I think, on the flight over to Paris. And I was talking to him and I said, you did North by Northwest? You built Mount Rushmore? Like, I just didn't, you know, there was no Google. And I couldn't go to the, I don't know, somehow it never came up, his great work history. So he was the kindest, sweetest person in the world, and very humble, very humble.
And you also got to meet Cary Grant. I was wondering if you could share the story of how that happened, because it's great.
How much time do you have?
You have 2 minutes, exactly.
2 minutes? You can get
going. We will wait.
This is one of the great adventures of my life. But when I was in my 20s, so long ago, I was very good friends with Gene Siskel. Do you remember Siskel and Ebert? So Gene was a friend of mine, and I knew him before he became a film critic. And I remember, actually, I was in college, and my phone rang, and it was him. He said, guess what? The paper wants me to be the film critic. I said, do you know a lot about movies? He said, I'm going to learn everything. It was really cute. But anyway, he was out here visiting, he was out here for the paper doing an interview with Cary Grant, and he called me and he said, hey, I'm out for a couple days, you know, do you want to have dinner? And I said, who are you interviewing? He said, Cary Grant. I said, Gene, I'm begging you. Is there some way I can meet him? He said, I don't know, I'm going to his house. And anyway, the next day he called, he said, well, I met him. He's invited me to go to Palm Springs.
Oh my gosh.
With he and this woman he was dating and spend the weekend there and do the interview there. And I think he's going to invite me. He said, you can drive me to the airport. So I picked him up in my Toyota, and it was a private airfield. I forget where we were, but I remember that I was kind of parked almost on the tarmac. And I said, can I get out of the car? He said, yeah, come on, I'll introduce yourself. So we got there first, and then this limousine in town car, I think it was, pulled up, and Cary Grant got out, looking just like Cary Grant. tall and beautiful and tan, and it was great. And so we got out of my Toyota, and we walked over to them, and Gene introduced me to him. And he said, well, this is wonderful, this is marvelous, come on, let's go. And he put his hand on my back and started to lead me up the stairs of the plane. And I went. Never saw my car again. No, not after the weekend. But when we got up there, there was a It was a private plane owned by Fabergé, who he was involved with through kind of work. And we got up on the plane, and there was a table with two seats on one side and two on the other. And he showed me into my seat, and she sat next to me and was like, and I spent the whole weekend with him. And when I came down for breakfast the second day in the same clothes, I confessed what happened. And he said, I've never known a woman that would go away without her makeup. And I said, well, I don't know what I said. But that was it. It was an incredible weekend. I came home, I just wrote down every single thing that happened in 4 years. It was an amazing weekend. He was as lovely as could be. And I got to sit in on the interview that Gene was doing with him. So, you know, he said things like, I'll give you a couple of things he said. And you can look this interview up in the Chicago Tribune. I am not mentioned in it. You can see his recording. But, you know, one thing he said when Gene would ask a lot of questions about his work, and he'd say, I'm always and always have been far more interested in what goes on at the candy counter. And then Gene sort of did a rapid fire with the actresses, and if he could just say a little something about each one. And my favorite was when Gene said Ingrid Bergman, he said, Ingrid always smelled great. So when I see them in a movie together, I'm always imagining what the scent is. But he thought he had the best on-screen rapport with Irene Dunne, which I would say love Grace Kelly the most. Read the article, and we'll see all of that.
Well, I'm sure most of us would have done exactly the same thing if Carrie had his head. Let's see
a show of hands of how many people would have gone up on the plane.
It's such a great story, and we could nerd out all day about Cary Grant and this movie, but we better get to it. So please thank Nancy Myers.
Congratulations, Lindsay, on all the hard work that you've done in putting this festival together, you and your whole team. Thank you so much. We're all so grateful. And Lindsay also oversees the book program, so she holds a near and dear place to my heart. I am so lucky, as I said last night, that I get to host all three of the poolside screenings this weekend. It was Clue last night. Hope some of you were here. Get you tonight. And Footloose tomorrow, so please come back. But let me tell you something. You who are here tonight, and thank you for braving these slightly chilly LA temperatures, you are in for a real treat, because you're gonna meet a new friend of mine, one of the members of the Four Preps, which is the boy band, let's use that phrase, because you use it yourself, Bruce, that sings the Gidget theme song and also is seen singing the song Cinderella in Gidget. Please help me welcome the fantastic Bruce Bellin.
Hello.
It's so great to see you.
Thank you. I'm known as the last prep standing.
You are the last prep standing. And I do, before we get going, I do want to mention Ed Cobb, Marv Ingram, and Glenn Larson, who were the other members of the Four Preps, the original members. Who sadly are no longer with us, but Bruce, we are so happy you're here. Now, Bruce is going to sit with me and answer some questions, but for those of you who are unaware, around the time that the Four Preps were asked to be in the film Gidget, the same year that the Gidget was filmed, 1958, it came out in 59, the Four Preps had two massive hits, one called Big Man and one called 26 Miles, which is about Catalina Island, written by Bruce Bellin. And I heard you still know a little bit of it.
Well, I wasn't going to do it after I volunteered to do it, because I'm the world's worst ukulele player. Somebody said, you wrote two hit songs on a ukulele. How could you be terrible at it? I'm terrible at it. I know four chords and I forget them. Anyhow, I tried to back out of doing this, and this lovely lady, Dory, who helped set all this up, said, oh, you got to do a few bars of 26 miles. So bear with me and my Stradivarius here. This is a $12.99 ukulele from Target. $26 36 miles across the sea. Santa Catalina is waiting for me. Santa Catalina, the island of romance. Romance, romance, romance. Water all around it, everywhere. Tropical trees and the salt. That's enough, isn't it?
That's amazing!
Thank you. You're very talented. Thank you. I'm gonna go home and learn that song. I like it.
Here, I'm gonna trade you the ukulele for a microphone. Oh, we have people to even take it. We have ukulele handlers here at TCM Film Festival. Bruce, that was fantastic. Okay, so take me back to 1958. You've had these two massive hits. Can you say that that's what led to the four of you getting the part in Gidget?
Yeah, very much so. We got, because of 26 Miles and the fact that our first album cover featured us in bathing suits on the beach of Malibu, we got very much identified with the beach culture in Southern California. And having had a couple of million sellers, we hoped and prayed, because we all knew Gidget. We went to high school at Hollywood High at the same time Gidget was at University High. I knew her. And we all knew about the book coming out. We all knew it was a hit. We all knew it was going to be a movie. And oh my God, who do they get? They got Sandra Dee. Oh my God, we could be in this movie. We had a wish list, and the one thing on a wish list we hadn't done yet, we had Million Sellers and we did Ed Sullivan, we hadn't done a movie. So for a week, our agent said, we're submitting you, they're considering you, and so forth. And the next thing we knew, we got the call, not only that we were going to be in the movie, but if you're in the business, you know how important this is. We're going to do a song on screen. That was the first good news. A week later, they said, and Jimmy Darren was going to sing the opening theme song, but Columbia would like you guys to sing that as well. So we found ourselves from wishing we'd be in a movie to being in Dick Clark endorsed the new Surfer movie of the time, and it was quite an experience.
I just love it. Let's take a step back, because as I understand it, the four of you were basically discovered performing at a talent show at Hollywood High. Was it as simple as that?
It really wasn't as simple as that. That's the common legend, that we did a Hollywood High School talent show in which some people in the business were in attendance, but nobody made us an offer at that time. But somebody who had heard about us from that appearance at Capitol Records ultimately signed us. And when we signed, we were the youngest group ever to sign with a major record label. So somebody in recent years has tacked the boy band label on. I guess we were a boy band. We were 18 years old, a year out of Hollywood High, but we signed with Capitol.
And tell me the story, tell everyone else the story that you told me about. You have a bit of a history with this Hollywood Roosevelt Hotel.
I went to Hollywood High School, which if you go look off a certain angle of the roof here, I think you can probably see the track at Hollywood High. And in high school, I drove a delivery truck for a flower shop in Beverly Hills, and I delivered to a lot of stars that would come in the town for a movie and stay at the Hollywood Roosevelt, and Zsa Zsa Gabor and Jimmy Stewart and so forth. So as a kid from Hollywood High who drove a truck and drove flowers to the Roosevelt to visit stars, being here tonight, I can't really tell you what a high this is for me. This is very exciting and I'm very meaningful.
Thank you. So what are your recollections of the actual shoot? It was in the summer of 1958. You had had these big hits. How many days were you on the set and how did it go?
We were required to be on the set for, I think, 3 days. And I ended up being on for about a week because I loved hanging out there. There was no problem with that. And, you know, it was my first and only real movie experience. I had done a lot of acting on Ozzie and Harriet, which I was a regular on for 4 seasons. But it was a whole different experience being on a movie set with a director other than Ozzie, right, a man named Peter Wenkos, who became a very dear friend of mine in later years. So the whole thing was quite magical to me, and I couldn't get the set early enough. I also told all the guys in the band that I was gonna court Sandra Dee and win her heart, which was a whole disaster I won't go into.
But why not?
Anyhow, from the first day, maybe because it was my first and really only movie of any significance, it was just a high for me, and everybody seemed to have the same. We weren't making, you know, love and death in Russia. We were making a surfer movie about a gutsy little girl, and you could not ask for a better actress to capture that vulnerability and that toughness that Sandra Dee had in it. She was a perfect choice for it.
Absolutely.
And the whole set, Doug McClure was one of the extras that played one of the surfers who was in the Virginian. Burt Metcalf, who went on to produce. In fact, if you look on the shot in Gidget, when we're on the sand performing, at one point there's a two shot with me on the left and Glenn on screen right. And in the middle is a fella clapping his hands along with him and dancing, a surfer. It's Burt Metcalf, who ended up producing MASH for 11 seasons. Also, we had in the cast Tom Laughlin, who went and created a movie called Billy Jack. It was just a marvelous experience. Joby Baker, who went on to be a good actor and a fine artist. So the whole week for me, other than the fact that I tried to say hello to Saturday in the hallway and bumped into a water fountain and knocked me on my ass, it was a joyful experience. Even that was sort of fun.
So did you actually get to talk to her?
I finally worked on my nerve the third day. The first 2 days she came in next to me at the donut table. And I, who can't ever stop talking, couldn't find any words to talk to her. And finally, the third day, I got my nerve up in the hallway. She was walking towards me, and I'm walking towards her. We're the only two people on the planet now. I gotta say it, hello, it's the third day. So I turned, and she passed me and said, hi, and bumped into a water fountain, and it knocked me on my ass. So my first words from Sandra D, oh my God, are you okay? That's how I blew it with Sandra D.
Did you ever have a second chance to make a first impression?
No, this guy named Bobby Darin started coming around and I was out of the picture.
So tell me about it, because, well, so first of all, people should know, when you see the four preps in the movie, it's when they're singing the song Cinderella. So look out for the guy who's got the saxophone in his hands, that's Bruce. And was that an instrument that you knew well?
I didn't know it at all. And about 3 minutes before we were all lighted, we had our makeup, we had our costumes, and the other three guys had our instruments, and I'm standing there with, thinking, okay, I'm just gonna sing. And
well, you're the lead singer.
And the director, Pete, walks up to me with the saxophone and says, you know how to play this thing? I said, an actor never says, no, I can't do it. Yes, I can roller skate, I can ride a bike, yeah. So I said, oh yeah, I can fake it, no problem. So actually, I must have done a pretty good job, because even friends who knew me after they watched the movie said, man, you really got some chops on that sax. I can't play the saxophone. I'm a faker.
Well, you're pretty convincing. So do you remember then when the movie came out in 1959, did the four of you get to go to like a big gala screening? Did you go to a movie? What was your first opportunity to see yourself on a big screen?
I can't remember where it was, but it wasn't in what I hoped it would be, a Hollywood premiere with everybody there. We were on the road. The only problem with having hit records is you're never home. So I think we probably saw it in, you know, Des Moines, Iowa or something one night. So we didn't have the opportunity of doing the whole Hollywood number, but just being in a movie for us was a big thing to cross off our wish list. It was a wonderful, wonderful experience.
I love it. And first of all, I just want to say, hope you don't mind, this man is 87 years old. And I want to sit and talk to you like all night. And by the way, I want everyone to know, because this guy is a wealth of stories, he has his own book. It's called Icons, Idols, and Idiots of Hollywood, My Adventures in America's First Boy Band, written by Bruce Bellin. So if you want to learn more about Bruce, you should check that out.
But the kids need milk. I hope you'll buy the thing. The kids need milk.
Tell me about how much music has been in your life, you know, in the decades since. I know the four preps have been in different incarnations throughout the years, and you've been performing, you know, all of your life.
I have. There have been three incarnations of the four preps. The first of the original group started in Hollywood High in 1954 and disbanded in 1969 after 13 years on Capitol Records. There was a 20-year hiatus, and then in 1989 at Dick Clark's suggestion, Ed Cobb of the original four preps and I reformed the group in kind of a super group with Jim Pike from the Letterman and David Somerville from the Diamonds, and for 10 years we toured as the second version of the four preps. And then after a few years, Jim Pike retired and Jim Yester of the Association joined the group. So for a few more years, the four preps consisted of David Somerville, Jim Yester of the Association, Ed Cobb and myself from the four preps. And then that disbanded. In 2005, we got together for a one-night-only performance on PBS for Magic Moments. And that was 2005, and we did a couple of numbers, and everybody went back to their civilian lives, and suddenly the phone started to ring and said, we'd like to line up a Four Preps tour. Well, there was no Four Preps. I organized it with a couple of members of the Crew Cuts and one from the Diamonds, and from 2007 to 2019 toured until COVID put an end to our touring. But I'm 87, and I'm putting a one-man show together, and I'm having a great time, so.
I mean, come on. Before I let you go, when is the last time you saw Gidget on a screen of any size?
I've never seen her on a screen of any size. I mean, I have a giant, I'm somewhat vision impaired, so I have a giant screen at home, and I've seen it on that, but not what I'm about to see it tonight. I am totally stoked about this.
Oh my gosh. Ladies and gentlemen, please help me thank the fantastic Bruce Bellin.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Mr. Director Influencer. He came at a bargain, I think, on this.
Apologies in advance to Andrew Callis of Paramount Archives.
So we're excited today to share with you the story behind the making of one of our favorite Atomic Age science fiction films. Here at the festival, we've done a few of these films from the same era, like War of the Worlds and When Worlds Collide. But today we leave outer space and we come down to Earth to see and hear one of the best of what I would call atomic horror films.
These films emerged because of the anxieties of the atomic bomb testing during the height of the Cold War. It reflected the anxieties and the uncertainties that audiences had at that time.
Now, during the peak of the Cold War, there was the public's fear of atomic bomb testing was profound. There was a lot of uncertainty. They knew the bomb was, of course, would create physical annihilation and fallout, but there was perhaps untold consequences, and the threat might be mutation.
This photograph is of atomic bomb testing in the Nevada desert, and the U.S. Army actually set off over 1,000 of these things, and it became so frequent that people would go to Las Vegas to party and watch bombs explode.
A couple of other favorite atomic films include, at this time, Ray Harryhausen's The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, directed by Eugene Lurier.
And, of course, Godzilla, which was directed by Ishiro Hondo.
John Wayne.
Yeah. Ishiro Hondo. And made the same year as them. And, of course, the Godzilla franchise is still enormously successful with Godzilla Minus One winning the Oscar for visual effects. But the best of all them is them. Interestingly, though, the plan for them was to be a much bigger budgeted picture. It was going to be originally filmed in stereo 3D, in widescreen, and in color, but something happened. What was that, Ben?
Well, following the success of Ray Harryhausen's Beast from 20,000 Fathoms the year before, that was a low-budget film, only cost $200,000. I mean, Warner Brothers bought it for $200,000, released it, and it earned $5 million. So that was an astounding and very appealing financial return on the investment. So the decision was made to reduce the budget of them and emulate the success of the Ray Harryhausen film as a low-budget science fiction production.
This memo is from Steve Trilling, who was one of the production managers on the film, and he does explain that.
Yeah, he says it'll be definitely in black and white, straight, no 3D. We want to cut every corner to bring down the costs and get effective shock treatment along the lines of The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, only much better.
Of course.
That sounds like studio executives.
Yeah, much better. Yeah. The budget was reduced to $650,000, which ended up being a good idea because while Them was successful, not quite as successful as a Harryhausen film, it made $2.2 million in its day, which is, adjusted for inflation, about $25
million. Wow. The story began in the imagination of writer George Worthing Yates, and his original outline for the film and his treatment was a film of broader, considerably broader expanse and epic nature than what was eventually made. He had swarms of ants coming out of the desert, destroying Navajo communities, the fight moving to the Rocky Mountains, a battle with the Air Force, the Army, and the climax of the film would take place, a battle between man and ants in the subway tunnels of New York City.
Yeah, I would have loved to have seen that. Unfortunately, though, New York was not particularly excited about the idea of Warner Brothers filming in their subway system. So Ted Schuerdeman decided to rewrite the script yet again and look for some other alternatives, also collapsing the picture a bit in its scope from what Ben mentioned, pretty much doing it on sets and locations here in Los Angeles.
The question remained, though, for where they staged this climactic ending of the film. Now, Schuerdeman remembered a film he had seen, a film noir classic called He Walked by Night, showcasing a shootout with Richard Basehart beneath the streets of Los Angeles, and that seemed to point in some direction of possibility.
This was now going to be the new location for the climax of the film, where the ants had their nest ready to take over the rest of Los Angeles.
And cheaper than going to New York City. Exactly.
But still,
yeah. Oh, yeah, we know it came out good.
Oh, that's me. Sorry. Director Gordon Douglas. This is the director, Gordon Douglas. He had just completed The Charge of Feather River, which was for Warner Brothers, also in stereo, because remember, Them was going to be in stereo. And he brought his expertise to the film. He had a long career spanning many genres, from dramas to comedies, and he really sort of brought the picture on board with how it is today.
Now here he is with actress Joan Weldon, but he's not only directing her, but also The Wind and the Sand, which is a big part of this film, the way it was envisioned.
Wind, Sand, and Weldon.
That's not a bad epic novel. Douglas had built his career at Hal Roach Studios as an actor, an assistant director on the Laurel and Hardy films, and even a director on Our Game and the Laurel and Hardy films. He got his first feature opportunity at the Roach Studios in 1939 with Zenobia. It's Gordon Douglas on the right. I don't think we have to introduce Oliver Hardy and Jim Lang on the left.
Douglas would go on to direct Jerry Lewis in the film Way, Way Out, and also the spy spoof In Like Flint with James Coburn, and then eventually in the 70s, he would direct Sidney Poitier in They Call Me Mr. Tibbs.
So here's Douglas on location for Them out of the Palmdale Desert, the site of many of these Atomic Age films, and with the principal cast members, James Whitmore on the left, lovable Chris Kringle, Edmund Gwynn, playing the befuddled scientist in the middle, Joan Weldon, and then big guy, James Arness, on the right.
Director Douglas was firm that Joan Weldon's character would portray a serious scientist, equally resilient to the men, and most importantly, not just a love interest for James Arness.
But somebody didn't get the memo. They're in publicity photos. I can't quite figure this picture out, but it looks like they were enjoying a cozy romantic evening in the storm thing when an ant suddenly cut in.
This doesn't seem to be where you want to take it.
Yeah, it's awkwardly sort of presented. But of course, that aside, the major concern for the production was the creation of the giant ants. Warner Brothers didn't want to spend the money, take the time that Ray Harryhausen had done to do stop motion, because that can often take 6 months, a year to get a small amount of film, and then involves a lot of optical compositing, expensive. No, they decided they'd go in a different direction.
Prop man from Warner Brothers, Dick Smith, was charged with creating full-scale, larger-than-life physical ants about 12 feet long, and they would be operated with hydraulics and pneumatic air lines and all kinds of things to sort of create this ant that the audience, not the audience, but the actors could actually interact with on the set. This was important because originally they were going to shoot it in stereo, and the feeling was if you could shoot everything at the same time, it would make the performances better.
Thanks to Warner Brothers and their stock footage library, shout out Aaron Smith, we were able to get some outtakes of the ants that are still in existence. And these are pretty much never before seen bits of footage. And we start with a slate.
Yeah, it's kind of fun to read slates. We always like to check out what's on it. You can see here it's scene 11, take one. It's a 35 millimeter lens, and Douglas is listed as the director. Hickox as the director of photography, and Shearer was the camera operator. And these scenes, as we are going to look at them, of course, are much longer than what's actually in the film. There will only be short little pieces of this. But a major plot point is that the ant comes over this ridge and looks down on Joan London, right? So this is the first take of trying to do that. And you can see here all the details and the brain and the ant, the antennas that are moving. It's high quality and really gross.
Yeah, it's got much. I never saw that oily looking mouth before.
So here you can see the pneumatic hydraulics that would allow the ant's head to tilt down like that, and the crew underneath are preparing it for a shot. Again, it's really fantastic to sort of see these behind the scenes that reveal how these ants work.
So we got some quotes from an article, an interview that Leonard Maltin did in 1970 with Gordon Douglas, which talked about this whole crew behind the ant, what operating the levers and wires and pulling on. Oh, here's the pulsing brain. Something you don't see in a movie. What are you thinking about?
Douglas's quote mentioned that he thought he could do a comedy based on just the people operating the ants, constantly tripping over each other and trying to get them to move realistically.
Probably from his Laurel and Hardy days.
Yeah. Another good decision is the blowing dust through the scene to sort of create a sense of we kind of see it, we kind of don't see it. It was a nice touch that Douglas brought to the film.
Now you can tell that they had to. Oh, here you are shooting antenna with a double take. I love the ant with the double take antennas. But here here you see the ant getting a colonoscopy.
Well, so the ants, of course, are on a dolly track and they're able to be pushed into the scene. And at a certain point, you have to cut away.
One thing I loved about the ants in this movie is they are portrayed as stoppable. In other words, with a machine gun, hand grenades, or flamethrower, you could kill an individual ant. And that concept allowed you to have fights that were, you know, that had more suspense because you could kill an ant or the second ant, but eventually you run out of bullets or there's too many ants.
Okay, watch this. It's good. Yeah. It's good.
Yeah, yeah.
It's still good.
But like any special effects outtake, it reveals itself off screen eventually. So the type of animation of this full size puppet really, they were pioneers at this, and it was quite an achievement in its day. And it was the precursor to more highly refined animatronic technology of today.
And here's an example. So this is a computer controlled animatronic hydraulic puppet full scale, and you can see the movements are now very slow, fluid, very smooth. This kind of technology developed for theme parks and of course the Jurassic Park series. But them were the pioneers in doing this.
Now we come to the sound. One of the things that fans and the movie-going public always mention when you bring the subject of this film up are the sound effects for the ants, the eerie sounds. In fact, often in the reviews of this film, the sound effects were mentioned,
yeah,
which is a real rarity. Sound never usually gets any kind of press, of course.
So, Ben, what produced the high-pitched singing and eerie ambience of the ants? Pete wrote that line for
him. Here's the response. Thank you for asking that question. It's like a cooking show. Now, the story of the sound behind the ants, I have a personal connection with it. And Warner Brothers was able to get access to some performers, you might say. The first one was a red-bellied woodpecker, like the sound. And also joining is a hooded warbler. All right. You don't think this adds up too much. And joining them in this chorus is a bird, gray tree frog, like so. But these are just the background players. In the foreground, we have the bird-voiced tree frog. All right?
There's going to be a test on this.
Yeah, there's a test later.
As you exit.
Here's what the bird-voiced tree frog sounds like. And if you put a couple of those together, you begin to get a bit of a chorus. And you go to a swamp in Georgia and record it. So you now get a little ambience of the location. And what do you know? You've got ready-made for you the ants in that. And you may ask, Greg, how did I know that?
Well,
how did I know that?
How did you know that, Dan?
Because as a child, I had the record. my father was interested in birds and animals in general, and we lived near the Laboratory of Ornithology in Ithaca, New York, and they recorded natural sounds. And they issued, around 1950 or 51, a record album of the sounds of toads and frogs across the United States. And we had this record, and when you play the record, you get the sounds of them, you know. Oh, wow, that's Jimmy Cagney, by the way. He comes later. You know, you get all these animals together. And so, you know, Warner Brothers just bought this record album, right, for $40. So, pretty economical, and it's And of course, just from a sound standpoint, you can build up the texture in the movie. You start out with the Treasure of Sierra Madre wind, okay, and you add the ants to it, and then a couple gunshots from Jimmy Cagney, you shoot an antenna, and you can, of course, have a flamethrower to get rid of it. So I really appreciate it. As a kid, I just love this.
This album is available on eBay. You can get your order in now. There's still a few left.
I think we're selling them at scalping prices. Yeah. Later on, you
should be at the TCM boutique. This is a picture of Dickie Bellis. He was one of the child actors in the film. In the climax of the movie, he's in front of stage 10 at Warner Brothers, and he's about to go in and do a scene with his brother Scotty Carell for the end of the film, and we have a little surprise from
He is still here and lives nearby, but unfortunately could not be here today, so he made a little video to share with you. Here it is.
Hi guys. Thanks for inviting me to come along on this retrospective trip. Well, 70 years ago, I was 8-year-old Dickie Bellis, child actor. And actually, I was indeed a child, but not much of an actor. At least by comparison to some of the talented young actors like Sandy Desher, who opens this movie with such a wonderful performance. I was a little too shy and a little self-conscious at that age. But my mother, who had spent some time being a stand-in and just loved being on the studio a lot, would find me a number of movie and television roles, and that gave us the chance to both spend some time in the studios. And in the 1950s, when Them was made, there was no CGI or green screen technology, so the sets and the ants, in this case, were physically created. And it was a pretty fun place for a kid. I remember being a little concerned after reading in the script about my character Mike having to cry in this one scene when the boys are rescued by James Whitmore. And Mom eased my fears by telling me about the makeup folks and how they could put glycerin tears on my cheeks, or sometimes they'd spray a mist of menthol in my eyes to make them water. And I found out that Gordon Douglas had another method. Unbeknown to me, when it came time to shoot this pretty important scene in the sewers. He was prepared. After a couple of rehearsals where I tried to act like I was crying, he asked the child welfare worker, the teacher on the set, to take my mom and go to the commissary. Not sure what the premise was that he used, but when they were gone, it cleared the way for a couple of questionable events. First was in the master shot. One of the ants is supposed to be threatening us and was actually hanging from wires about 20 feet from where I was standing. And it had to be shot with a real flamethrower and burned. Then they moved in for the close-up. And this was how Gordon got me to cry. And not just cry, but sob. Bell on the set rang, signaling for quiet, and Gordon started to say things like, "All right, Dickie, it's lunchtime and everyone on this set is hungry, but no one is going to leave until you're able to cry. You call yourself an actor? You can't cry?" Well, that pretty much started the waterworks. And in one take, he got the close-up he wanted. Everyone was released to go for lunch. Gordon came over to me, gave me a hug, and said, "Come on, let's go outside." And that's when he presented me with a football, newly purchased football, and still in the box. So he was a veteran filmmaker and was totally prepared to get the performance he wanted. So the two of us went out, threw the football around in the alley between the sound stages on the Warner Brothers lot. Now, full disclosure, while I remember that experience to this day, I was not psychologically damaged. It merely represents a life event that I remember. I was a very lucky kid. And about 35 years later, in 1990, in a whole different career, I received an Emmy Award for composing the score for the miniseries Stephen King's It. So between them and It, played a significant role.
So, Them was nominated for an Oscar that year, but unfortunately lost to 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, also a wonderful film.
It also missed out on the sound effects Oscar, but it did secure an NPSC, the Motion Picture Sound Editors Guild, award for best sound editing. It's called a MIPSE, and it was credited to sound supervisors William Muller and Francis Shy, and the Red-Bellied Woodpecker didn't get any credit at all.
Slide.
Well, Ben, haven't you forgotten something?
Oh, God. Actually, I have forgotten something. Ben, there's a kind of a scream thing that's in this movie that I hear in a lot of different movies, especially from Warner Brothers.
You forced
me.
Yeah,
you know
forced
what that
me.
Is? What is that?
Well, you forced me to talk about the Wilhelm. Okay, I would only bring it up in the context of this screening because there's more Wilhelms in this film than any other classic Warner Brothers film. It just has the greatest number. Not stuff added later by all of us deliberately, but you know, indigenous to the Warner Brothers process. So it's worth taking a note for that.
So count them and let us know what you came up with.
Now, there are a couple of cameos in this film that are worth taking a note of. Fess Parker appears has one scene, or I don't know, rather well-done scene in this movie, and this was just before he became Davy Crockett, and there's someone else occurred as well.
Yeah, there's also a young Leonard Nimoy with distinctively ordinary ears.
You sure about that? Take a quick look for him. But one of the iconic moments we all remember, aside from the sound is one, of course, is the opening scene.
Visual effects.
Oh, there's visual effects.
Yeah, there is.
Is the in the opening of the film, the scenes of the young child, the young lady, young girl, wandering in shock, aimlessly and speechlessly, in the desert. She was actress Sandy Descher. Well, guess what? We have her here today. It's a rare appearance, and we're going to bring her up now and have a talk with her. So please welcome Sandy Descher. Fantastic to have you here today, and so we're going to give you a few questions, and then I think you're going to present something kind of interesting. Craig, you want to start?
Well, you know, this is a great way to start a movie. You're seen in the movie, sets the whole movie off. You also create the title of the movie.
Yes.
And I was wondering if, you know, those scenes of you coming out of the desert are so emotionally impactful. What was your process for getting into character? Did the director talk to you about how you were supposed to act in that scene? Because it's a great way to start the movie.
Well, of course, I saw the ants on the trailers. So I wasn't afraid of the ants. They weren't moving at the time. They took me around, showed me. But it was the desert and the heat in a wool robe. That, the sand blowing, walking with your eyes open and being guided by Gordon Douglas walking backwards and saying, walk, Sandy, keep your eyes open, walk, 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 walk. And it was enough to put me in that trance. Everybody had on goggles, except me. And, it was just exciting.
Well, my question is, did you get a football?
I didn't get a football, but I may have gotten something to carry with me these 70 years. Gordon Douglas, in his antics of guiding me, crouched underneath the camera, sat on a cactus. And he just kind of breathed deeply, and my eyes just got bigger, and I just kept walking. And he kept saying, okay, Sandy, come. But the best part was when he yelled, cut. He went behind a trailer with the makeup man and had all of the thorns removed. And you heard this, yelp. With a few other words.
It's a long, happy moment, actually.
It was. So that was part of the sand.
Now, Sandy, there's something really great is that you brought something to share with us today.
I did.
And these are some home movies that your mother took.
She did.
Yes. And you allowed us to transfer them and share with the audience, so why don't we go ahead and play it, and we can kind of talk about what's going on.
I haven't seen these in...
Yeah, there's a monitor here. Yeah. So it starts at Warner Brothers, and that sign says,
it's
combining good citizenship with good filmmaking. It must have been the McCarthy era. So these were shot with your home movie camera. And if you want to comment on this arriving at the Warner Brothers offices.
Right.
It looked pretty much the same, except for
I
the
remember
old cars.
Walking up this walkway. My mom said, wait.
Is that your mom?
That is my mother.
Okay, so somebody else shot it.
Somebody else must have shot it. Yeah. I don't remember my dad being there, but he must have been.
Now, this must be the social worker or
this
teacher?
This would have been the teacher.
Uh-huh.
And I don't remember her name.
Miss Gulch.
Thank you.
Wrong studio.
Okay. Drayton and Clancy Cartier. So here's the Palmdale location.
Yes.
Very odd.
Which we left very early in the morning for.
Was it more than one day in the desert, or do you recall?
As I remember it, it was several days, maybe even three or four.
Oh, okay. We've slowed this down because things move pretty fast in the 8mm. This is the preparing for the dolly shot that they're doing.
Yes.
They have the tracks laid out.
There's that wonderful wool rope.
Some sort of... No, I think this is the crew, of course. I love those. Those are the Jack Warner trucks. They're red, mm-hmm. white, and blue. Very patriotic on all these productions.
That must be the script girl.
I think you're right. Uh-huh. That's John Ford arriving. I think he's in the film somewhere, but I couldn't quite. This must be Gordon Douglas with the blue shirt.
Yes, and the baseball cap.
Yeah, he had that hat in other pictures.
And that's Luz Potter. Little people, Luz Potter. Luz was my stand-in and double sometimes until she had to swing up on the back of a horse. And that's when the teacher disappeared. And
now,
I went.
Oh, really? Did she follow you on different films then?
Yes, she followed me for many years until I outgrew her.
Wow.
And she was a dear. She was part of the Munchkins.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Okay. One of the original Munchkins.
Oh, this is so sweet.
Yeah, so you were being loved by everyone on the set.
I can't tell you how much the thespians reached out to me as a child, but I knew my lines, and I was there, and we did it, and it was an adventure, but they were all so good to me, and especially him.
Yeah, Whitmore seems to have a real protective.
Now, this plane used to sometimes clip the tops of the brush.
Oh, dear.
Oh, no.
That was flying low.
So there's one of the, something on that truck there on the right.
There, that's an ant.
And here we go with James Arnold.
Look at that.
And William Shallow.
Yeah.
James Arnold is in that. Off camera. They got you up to meet
them. Oh, wow. They had hair, you know, a net. Uh-huh. They had, like, Malene or, you know, skirt netting.
Well, if you didn't have a
netting
dog,
over them, and then the hairs were on.
Well, at the ends.
That's quite great. An intro. That's the film.
Thank you for sharing that with us.
Another powerful scene, you don't want to give away everything in the movie, is when you are given the reminder, the smell of formic acid, which is the ant smell, and this is what is used as sort of a shock treatment.
And we're going to have a little toast here.
I thought we had a toast. Yeah, right. Is the doctor in the house here? We have our doctor with us. We have some formic acid you brought to me.
TCM can make anything happen. Including getting me here.
Thank you, Dr. Brian. And now you can inhale it or you can drink it.
What do you mean, smell?
I'm going to inhale it. I meant, smell it to see what it does to you. So it's you know, formic acid is in ants and they... It's like a nettle, it stings you, it's an organic irritant. But anyways, I'd like to give a toast.
Yeah, here we go. Here's to them.
To them. Thank you so much.